space-time to her, she'd just say, "What?" But that didn't mean she was ignorant. It just meant that she didn't have any truck with words, especially gibberish. She just knew that there were certain things that happened continually in human history, like three-dimensional clichés. Stories. "And now we're part of it, and I can't stop it," said Granny. "There's got to be a place where I can stop it, and I can't find it." The band struck up. It was playing a waltz. Magrat and the Prince whirled around the dance floor once, never taking their eyes off each other. Then a few couples dared to join them. And then, as if the whole ball was a machine whose spring had been wound up again, the floor was full of dancing couples and the sounds of conversation flowed back into the void. "Are you going to introduce me to your friend?" said Casanunda from somewhere near Nanny's elbow. People swept past them. "It's all got to happen," said Granny, ignoring the low-level interruption. "Everything, the kiss, the clock striking midnight, her running out and losing the glass slipper, everything."
"Yuck,"
said Nanny, leaning on her partner's head. "I'd rather lick toads."
"She looks just my type," said Casanunda, his voice slightly muffled. "I've always been very attracted to dominant women."
The witches looked at the whirling couple who were staring into one another's eyes.
"I could trip them up, no trouble," said Nanny.
"You can't. That's not something that can happen."
"Well, Magrat's sensible, more or less sensible," said Nanny. "Maybe she'll notice something's wrong."
"I'm good at what I do, Githa Og," said Granny. "She won't notice nothing until the clock strikes midnight."
They both turned to look up. It was barely nine.
"You know," said Nanny Og, "clocks don't strike midnight. Seems to me they just strike 12. I mean, it's just a matter of bongs."
They both looked up at the clock again. In the swamp, Legba the black cockerel crowed. He always crowed at sunset. Nanny Og pounded up another flight of stairs and leaned against the wall to catch her breath. It had to be somewhere around here.
"Another time you'll learn to keep your mouth shut, Githa Og," she muttered.
"I expect we're leaving the hurly-burly of the ball for an intimate tete-a-tete somewhere," said Casanunda, hopefully, trotting along behind her.
Nanny tried to ignore him and ran along a dusty passage. There was a balcony rail on one side looking down into the ballroom, and there a small wooden door. She rammed it open with her elbow. Within, mechanisms whirred in counterpoint to the dancing figures below, as if the clock was propelling them, which, in a metaphorical sense, it was.
Clockwork, Nanny thought. Once you know about clockwork, you know about everything.
I wish I bloody well knew about clockwork.
Very cosy, said Casanunda.
She squeezed through the gap and into the clock space. Cogwheels clicked past her nose. She stared at them for a moment.
Lorks! All this just to chop time up into little bits.
It might be just the teeniest bit cramped, said Casanunda, from somewhere near her armpit. But needs must, ma'am. I remember once in Quirm there was this sedan chair, and...
Let's see, thought Nanny. This bit is connected to that bit. This one turns. That one turns faster. This spiky bit wobbles backwards and forwards. Oh, well... Just twist the first thing you can grab, as the High Priest said to the Vestal Virgin.
This is the last line of a Discworld joke, lost, alas, to posterity. Nanny Og spat on her hands, gripped the largest cogwheel, and twisted. It carried on turning, pulling her with it.
Blimey! Oh, well!
Then she did what neither Granny Weatherwax nor Magrat would have dreamt of doing in the circumstances. But Nanny Og's voyages on the sea of intersexual dalliance had gone rather further than twice around the lighthouse, and she saw nothing demeaning in getting a man to help her. She simpered at Casanunda.
Things would be a lot more comfortable in our little pied de terre if you could just push this little wheel around a bit, she said. I'm sure you could manage it, she added.
Oh, no problem, good lady, said Casanunda.
He reached up with one hand. Dwarfs are immensely strong for their size. The wheel seemed to offer him no resistance at all. Somewhere in the mechanism, something resisted for a moment and then went clonk. Big wheels turned reluctantly. Little wheels screamed on their axles. A small important piece flew out and pinged off Casanunda's small bullet head. And, much faster than nature had ever intended, the hands sped around the face. A new noise right overhead made Nanny Og look up. Her self-satisfied expression faded. The hammer that struck the hours was swinging slowly backwards. it struck Nanny that she was standing right under the bell at the same time as the bell, too, was struck.
Bong! Oh, booger! Bong! Bong! Bong!
Mist rolled through the swamp, and shadows moved with it, their shapes indistinct on this night when the difference between the living and the dead was only a matter of time. Mrs. Gogol could feel them among the trees, the homeless, the hungry, the silent people, those forsaken by men and gods. The people of the mists and the mud, whose only strength was somewhere on the other side of weakness, whose beliefs were as rickety and homemade as their homes. And the people from the city, not the ones who lived in the big white houses and went to balls in fine coaches, but the other ones. They were the ones that stories are never about. Stories are not, on the whole, interested in swineherds who remain swineherds, and poor and humble shoemakers whose destiny is to die slightly poorer and much humbler. These people were the ones who made the magical kingdom work, who cooked its meals and swept its floors and carted its night soil, and were its faces in the crowd, and whose wishes and dreams, undemanding as they were of no consequence. The invisibles. And me out here, she thought, building traps for gods. There are various forms of voodoo in the multiverse, because it's a religion that can be put together from any ingredients that happen to be lying around. And all of them try, in some way, to call down a god into the body of a human being. That was stupid, Mrs. Gogol thought. That was dangerous. Mrs. Gogol's voodoo worked the other way about. What was a god? A focus of belief. If people believed, a god began to grow. Feebly at first, but if the swamp taught anything, it taught patience. Anything could be the focus of a god. A handful of feathers with a red ribbon around them, a hat and coat on a couple of sticks, anything. Because when all people had was practically nothing, then anything could be almost everything. And then you fed it, and lulled it like a goose heading for pate, and let the power grow very slowly, and when the time was ripe, you opened the path backwards. A human could ride the god rather than the other way round. There would be a price to pay later, but there always was. In Mrs. Gogol's experience, everyone ended up dying. She took a pull of rum and handed the jug to Saturday. Saturday took a mouthful and passed the jug up to something that might have been a hand.
"Let it begin," said Mrs. Gogol.
The dead man picked up three small drums and began to beat out a rhythm, heartbeat fast. After a while, something tapped Mrs. Gogol on the shoulder and handed her the jug. It was empty. Might as well begin.
Lady Bonanna, smile on me. Mr. Safeway, protect me. Stride Wide Man, guide me. Hotalogger Andrews, catch me. I stand between the light and the dark, but no matter, because I am between. Here is rum for you, tobacco for you, food for you, a home for you. Now you listen to me good.
Bong! For Magrat, it was like waking from a dream into a dream. She'd been idly dreaming that she was dancing with the most handsome man in the room, and she was dancing with the most handsome man in the room, except that he wore two circles of smoked glass over his eyes. Although Magrat was soft-hearted, a compulsive daydreamer, and, as Granny Weatherwax put it, a wet hen, she wouldn't be a witch if she didn't have certain instincts and the sense to trust them. She reached up, and before his hands could move, tweaked the things away. Magrat had seen eyes like that before, but never on something walking upright. Her feet, which a moment before had been moving gracefully across the floor, tripped over themselves. She began, and she was aware that his hands, pink and well manicured, were also cold and damp. Magrat turned and ran, knocking the couples aside in her madness to get away, her legs tangled in the dress. The stupid shoes skittered on the floor. A couple of footmen blocked the stairs to the hall. Magrat's eyes narrowed. Getting out was what mattered.
Hey! Ouch!
And then she ran on, slipping at the top of the stairs. A glass slipper slithered across the marble. How the hell's anyone supposed to move in these things? She screamed at the world in general. Hopping frantically on one foot, she wrenched the other shoe off and ran into the night. The prince walked slowly to the top of the steps and picked up the discarded slipper. He held it. The light glittered off its facets. Granny Weatherwax leaned against the wall in the shadows. All stories had a turning point, and it had to be close. She was good at getting into other people's minds, but now she had to get into hers. She concentrated. Down deeper, past everyday thoughts and minor concerns, faster, faster, through layers of deep cogitation, deeper, past things sealed off and crusted over, old guilts and congealed regrets. But there was no time for them now. Down, and there, the silver thread of the story. She'd been part of it, was part of it, so it had to be a part of her. It poured past. She reached out. She hated everything that predestined people, that fooled them, that made them slightly less than human. The story whipped along like a steel hawser. She gripped it. Her eyes opened in shock. Then she stepped forward.
"Excuse me, Your Highness." She snatched the shoe from the Duke's hands and raised it over her head.
Her expression of evil satisfaction was terrible to behold. Then she dropped the shoe. It smashed on the stairs. A thousand glittering fragments scattered across the marble. Coiled as it was around the length of turtle-shaped space-time known as the Discworld, the story shook. One broken end flapped loose and flailed through the night, trying to find any sequence to feed on. In the clearing, the trees moved. So did the shadows. Shadows shouldn't be able to move unless the light moves. These did. The drumming stopped. In the silence, there was the occasional sizzle as power cracked across the hanging coat. Saturday stepped forward. Green sparks flew out to his hands as he gripped the jacket and put it on. His body jerked. Erzulia Goggle breathed out.
"You are here," she said. "You are still yourself. You are exactly yourself."
Saturday raised his hands with his fists clenched. Occasionally an arm or leg would jerk as the power inside him squirrel-caged around in its search for freedom. But she could see that he was riding it.
"It will become easier," she said, more gently now.
Saturday nodded. With the power flowing inside him, he had, she thought, the fire he'd had when he was alive. He'd not been a particularly good man, she knew. Genua had not been a model of civic virtue. But at least he'd never told people that they wanted him to oppress them, and that everything he did was for their own good. Around the circle, the people of New Genua, the old New Genua, knelt or bowed. He hadn't been a kind ruler, but he'd fitted. And when he'd been arbitrary or arrogant or just plain wrong, he'd never suggested that this was justified by anything other than the fact that he was bigger and stronger and occasionally nastier than other people. He'd never suggested that it was because he was better. And he'd never told people they ought to be happy and imposed a kind of happiness on them. The invisible people knew that happiness is not the natural state of mankind and is never achieved from the outside in. Saturday nodded again, this time in satisfaction. When he opened his mouth, sparks flashed between his teeth. And when he waded through the swamp, the alligators fought to get out of his way. It was quiet in the palace kitchens now. The huge trays of roast meat, the pigs' heads with apples in their mouths, the multi-layered trifles, had long ago been carried upstairs. There was a clattering from the giant sinks at the far end, where some of the maids were making a start on the washing up. Mrs. Pleasant, the cook, had made herself a plate of red stripe fish in crawfish sauce. She wasn't the finest cook in Genua. No one got near Mrs. Goggle's gumbo. People would almost come back from the dead for a taste of Mrs. Goggle's gumbo. But the comparison was as narrow as that between, say, diamonds and sapphires. She'd done her best to cook up a good banquet because she had her professional pride, but there wasn't much she felt she was able to do with lumps of meat. Genuine cooking, like the best cooking everywhere in the multiverse, had been evolved by people who had to make desperate use of ingredients their masters didn't want. No one would even try a bird's nest unless they had to. Only hunger would make a man taste his first alligator. No one would eat a shark's fin if they were allowed to eat the rest of the shark. She poured herself a rum and was just picking up the spoon when she felt herself being watched. A large man in a black leather doublet was staring at her from the doorway, dangling a ginger cat mask from one hand. It was a very direct stare. Mrs. Pleasant found herself wishing she'd done something about her hair and was wearing a better dress.
"Yes," she said. "What do you want?"
"Want food, Mrs. Pleasant," said Gribo.
She looked him up and down. There were some odd types in Genua these days. This one must have been a guest at the ball, but there was something
very familiar about him. Gribo wasn't a happy cat. People had made a fuss just because he dragged a roast turkey off the table. Then the skinny female with the teeth had kept simpering at him and saying she'd see him later in the rose garden, which wasn't at all the cat way of doing things, and that had got him confused, because this wasn't the right kind of body, and nor was hers. And there were too many other males around. Then he'd smelt the kitchen. Cats gravitate to kitchens like rocks gravitate to gravity.
"I seen you somewhere before," said Mrs. Pleasant.
Gribo said nothing. He'd followed his nose to a bowl on one of the big tables.
"What?"
he demanded.
"Fish heads," said Mrs. Pleasant.
They were technically garbage, although what she was planning with some rice and a few special sauces would turn them into the sort of dish kings fight for.
"Want,"
Gribo repeated. Mrs. Pleasant shrugged.
"You want raw fish heads, man? You take 'em," she said.
Gribo lifted the bowl uncertainly. He wasn't too good with fingers. Then he looked around conspiratorially and ducked under the table. There were the sounds of keen gurgitation and the bowl being scraped around on the floor. Gribo emerged.
"Milk?"
he suggested. Fascinated, Mrs. Pleasant reached for the milk jug and a cup.
"Saucer,"
Gribo said. And a saucer. Gribo took the saucer, gave it a long, hard look, and put it on the floor. Mrs. Pleasant stared. Gribo finished the milk, licking the remnant of his beard. He felt a lot better now, and there was a big fire over there. He padded over to it, sat down, spat on his paw, and made an attempt to clean his ears, which didn't work because inexplicably neither ears nor paw were the right shape, and then curled up as best he could, which wasn't very well, given that he seemed to have the wrong sort of backbone, too. After a while, Mrs. Pleasant heard a low, asthmatic rumble. Gribo was trying to purr. He had the wrong kind of throat. In a minute, he was going to wake up in a bad temper and want to fight something. Mrs. Pleasant got on with her own supper. Despite the fact that a hulking great man had just eaten a bowl of fish heads and lapped a saucer of milk in front of her and was now stretched out uncomfortably in front of the fire, she found she didn't feel the least bit afraid. In fact, she was fighting down an impulse to scratch his tummy. Magrat wrenched off the other slipper as she ran down the long red carpets towards the palace gateway and freedom. Just getting away, that was the important thing. From was more urgent than to. And then two figures drifted out of the shadows and faced her. She raised the slipper pathetically as they approached in absolute silence, but even in the twilight she could feel their gaze. The crowds parted. Lily Weatherwax glided through in a rustle of silk. She looked Granny up and down without any expression of surprise. "All in white, too," she said dryly. "My word, aren't you the nice one?"
"But I've stopped you," said Granny, still panting with the effort. "I've broken it."
Lily Weatherwax looked past her. The Snake Sisters were coming up the steps, holding a limp Magrat between them.
"Save us from people who think literally," said Lily. "The damn things come in pairs, you know."
She crossed to Magrat and snatched the second slipper out of her hand.
"The clock was interesting," she said, turning back to Granny. "I was impressed with the clock. But it's no good, you know. You can't stop this sort of thing. It has the momentum of inevitability. You can't spoil a good story. I should know."
She handed the slipper to the prince, but without taking her eyes off Granny.
"It'll fit her," she said.
Two of the courtiers held Magrat's leg as the prince wrestled the slipper past her protesting toes.
"There," said Lily, still without looking down, "and do stop trying that hedge witch hypnotism on me, Esme."
"It fits," said the prince, but in a doubtful tone of voice.
"Yes, anything would fit," said a cheerful voice from somewhere towards the back of the crowd, "if you were allowed to put two pairs of hairy socks on first."
Lily looked down. Then she looked at Magrat's mask. She reached out and pulled it off.
"Ow!" "Wrong girl," said Lily. "But it still doesn't matter, Esme, because it is the right slipper, so all we have to do is find the girl whose foot it fits."
There was a commotion at the back of the crowd. Courtiers parted, revealing Nanny Ogg oil-covered and hung with spider-webs. "If it's a 5½ narrow fit, I'm your man," she said. "Just let me get these boots off."
"I wasn't referring to you, old woman," said Lily coldly.
"Oh, yes, you was," said Nanny. "We know how this bit goes, see? The prince goes all round the city with the slipper, trying to find the girl whose foot fits. That's what you was planning, so I can save you a bit of trouble. How about it?" There was a flicker of uncertainty in Lily's expression. "A girl," she said, "of marriageable age."
"No problem there," said Nanny cheerfully.
The dwarf Casanunda nudged a courtier proudly in the knees.
"She's a very close personal friend of mine," he said proudly.
Lily looked at her sister.
"You're doing this. Don't think I don't know," she said.
"I ain't doing a thing," said Granny. "It's real life happening all by itself."
Nanny grabbed the slipper out of the prince's hands, and before anyone else could move, slid it onto her foot. Then she waggled the foot in the air. It was a perfect fit.
"There," she said. "See? You could have wasted the whole day."
"Especially because there must be hundreds of 5½ narrow fit wearers in a city this size," Granny went on. "Unless, of course, you happen to sort of go to the right house right at the start. If you had, you know, a lucky guess."
"But that'd be cheating," said Nanny. She nudged the prince.
"I'd just like to add," she said, "that I don't mind doing all the waving and opening things and all the royal stuff, but I draw the line at sleeping in the same bed as Sonny Jim here."
"Because he doesn't sleep in a bed," said Granny.
"No, he sleeps in a pond," said Nanny. "We had a look. Just a great big indoor pond."
"Because he's a frog," said Granny.
"With flies all over the place in case he wakes up in the night and fancies a snack," said Nanny.
"I thought so," said Magrat, pulling herself out of the grip of the guards. "He had clammy hands."
"Lots of men have clammy hands," said Nanny, "but this one's got 'em because he's a frog."
"I'm a prince of blood royal," said the prince, "and a frog."
"I don't mind," said Casanunda from somewhere down below. "I enjoy open relationships. If you want to go out with a frog, it's fine by me."
Lily looked around at the crowd, then she snapped her fingers. Granny Weatherwax was aware of a sudden silence. Nanny Ogg looked up at the people on either side of her. She waved a hand in front of a guard's face.
"Cool," she said. "You can't do that for long," said Granny. "You can't stop 1,000 people for long."
Lily shrugged. "They're not important. Whoever will remember who was at the ball, they'll just remember the flight and the slipper and the happy ending."
"I've told you, you can't start it again, and he's a frog. Even you can't keep him in shape the whole day long. He turns back into his old shape at night. He's got a bedroom with a pond in it." "He's a frog," said Granny flatly.
"But only inside," said Lily.
"Inside's where it counts," said Granny.
"Outside's quite important, mind," said Nanny.
"Lots of people are animals inside. Lots of animals are people inside," said Lily. "Where's the harm?"
"He's a frog, especially at night," said Nanny.
It had occurred to her that a husband who was a man all night and a frog all day might be almost acceptable. You wouldn't get the wage packet, but there'd be less wear and tear on the furniture. She also couldn't put out of her mind certain private speculations about the length of his tongue.
"And you killed the Baron," said Magrat.
"You think he was a particularly nice man?" said Lily. "Besides, he didn't show me any respect. If you've got no respect, you've got nothing."
Nanny and Magrat found themselves looking at Granny. "He's a frog."
"I found him in the swamp," said Lily. "I could tell he was pretty bright. I needed someone amenable to persuasion. Shouldn't frogs have a chance? He'll be no worse a husband than many. Just one kiss from a princess seals the spell."
"A lot of men are animals," said Magrat, who'd picked up the idea from somewhere.
"Yes, but he's a frog."
"Look at it my way," said Lily. "You see this country? It's all swamps and fogs. There's no direction."
But I can make this a great city. Not a sprawling place like Ankh-Morpork, but a place that works.
The girl doesn't want to marry a frog.
What will that matter in 100 years' time?
It matters now.
Lily threw up her hands. What do you want, then? It's your choice. There's me, or there's that woman in the swamp. Light or dark, fog or sunshine, dark chaos or happy endings.
He's a frog and you killed the old Baron, said Granny.
You'd have done the same, said Lily.
No, said Granny. I'd have thought the same, but I wouldn't have done it.
What difference does that make, deep down? You mean, you don't know, said Nanny Og. Lily laughed. Look at the three of you, she said, bursting with inefficient good intentions, the maiden, the mother, and the crone. Who are you calling a maiden? Said Nanny Og. Who are you calling a mother? Said Magrat.
Granny Weatherwax glowered briefly like the person who has discovered that there is only one straw left, and everyone else has drawn a long one.
Now, what shall I do with you? Said Lily. I really am against killing people unless it's necessary, but I can't have you running around acting stupidly. She looked at her fingernails. So I think I shall have you put away somewhere until this has run its course, and then, can you guess what I'm going to do next? I'm going to expect you to escape, because after all, I am the good one.
Ella walked cautiously through the moonlit swamp, following the strutting shape of Legba. She was aware of movement in the water, but nothing emerged. Bad news like Legba gets around, even among alligators. An orange light appeared in the distance. It turned out to be Mrs. Goggle's shack, or boat, or whatever it was. In the swamp, the difference between the water and the land was practically a matter of choice.
Hello? Is anyone there? Come along in, child. Take a seat. Rest up a little.
Ella stepped cautiously onto the rocking veranda. Mrs. Goggle was sitting in her chair, a white-clad raggedy doll in her lap.
Magrat said, I know all about it. Come to Erzulia.
Who are you?
I am your friend, girl.
Ella moved so as to be ready to run.
You're not a godmother of any kind, are you? No, no gods, just a friend. Did anyone follow you?
Don't think so.
It's no matter if they did, girl, no matter if they did. Maybe we ought to move out into the river for a spell, even so. We'll be a lot safer with water all around.
The shack lurched.
You'd better sit down. The feet make it shaky until we get into deep water.
Ella risked a look, nevertheless. Mrs. Goggle's hut travelled on 4 large duck feet, which were now rising out of the swamp. They splashed their way through the shallows and gently sculled out into the river. Gribo woke up and stretched. And the wrong sort of arms and legs. Mrs. Pleasant, who had been sitting watching him, put down her glass.
"What do you want to do now, Mr. Cat?" she said.
Gribo padded over to the door into the outside world and scratched at it.
"Want to go out, Mrs. Pleasant?" he said.
"You just have to turn the handle there," she said.
Gribo stared at the door handle like someone trying to come to terms with a piece of very advanced technology, and then gave her a pleading look. She opened the door for him, stood aside as he slunk out, and then shut it, locked it, and leaned against it.
"Ember's bound to be safe with Mrs. Goggle," said Magrat.
"Heh," said Granny. "I quite liked her," said Nanny Og.
"I don't trust anyone who drinks rum and smokes a pipe," said Granny.
"Nanny Og smokes a pipe and drinks anything," Magrat pointed out.
"Yes, but that's because she's a disgusting old baggage," said Granny, without looking up.
Nanny Og took her pipe out of her mouth.
"That's right," she said amiably. "You ain't nothing if you don't maintain an image."
Granny looked up from the lock.
"Can't shift it," she said. "It's Octoron too. Can't magic it open."
"It's daft, locking us up," said Nanny. "I'd have had us killed." "That's because you're basically good," said Magrat. "The good are innocent and create justice. The bad are guilty.
which is why they invent mercy.
Now I know why she's done this, said Granny darkly. It's so's we'll know we've lost.
But she said we'd escape, said Magrat. I don't understand. She must know the good ones always win in the end.
Only in stories, said Granny, examining the door hinges. And she thinks she's in charge of the stories. She bends them round herself. She thinks she's the good one.
Mind you, said Magrat, I don't like swamps. If it wasn't for the fog and everything, I'd see Lily's point.
Then you're nothing but a daft godmother, snapped Granny, still fiddling with the lock. You can't go around building a better world for people. Only people can build a better world for people. Otherwise, it's just a cage. Besides, you don't build a better world by chopping heads off and giving decent girls away to frogs.
But progress, Magrat began.
Don't you talk to me about progress. Progress just means bad things happen faster. Anyone got another hat pin? This one's useless.